think we more or less got here last time. I think that's actually the last foil we did last time, which pointed out that how we could sort of understand, here we have a problem, and here we have a computer, and we're sort of taking some sort of fixed problem here and a fixed computer here, and then we're choosing sort of various resting stages in the middle for sort of what we're compiling or linking to. A very high-level thing is nearer the problem, and a low-level description, which is what a compiler produces, nearer the computer. So here's sort of this represented in a different way. So here we have a bunch of problem architectures. Here we have a bunch of machine architectures. And this is meant to compare message passing and a language like high-performance Fortran. So if I take message passing, then I'm defining an interface which is sort of here. So here we have the machine, here we have the problem. So that message passing is an interface that looks like the computer. And so message passing has the advantage it does all problems. So we sort of see the message passing is a way of mapping all problems but onto a programming model that looks like a computer. If we take something like a data parallel language, which actually, well, the original HPF was what I called synchronous problems, and hopefully it will be synchronous and the more dynamic, loosely synchronous problems. So that's up here. And so that's near a particular problem architecture, but it then is meant to map onto all machine architectures. So you have this sort of interesting structure of choices as to what type of representation you use. All right. Alright, so so this is, I think, a remark I've already made, namely the goal of languages or computer languages ought to be, in my opinion, to express problems, and the goal of a language is to express a problem, not a machine. I mean, maybe assembly language is meant to express the machine, but the language users use is meant to express the problem. And I would claim that if you look at the so-called issues with parallelism, all the issues with parallelism, like we can't compile Fortran 77 very well, it's because we have not expressed the problem very precisely, and we've hidden the intrinsic parallelism in the problem. So, and that's in fact why you would hope languages such as Java or Fortran 90, which are object-oriented, should do better. Because by using a higher level, a closer description of the problem, you ought to be able to have a better chance of producing either a high-performance or good parallel implementation. Because the problems that we're talking about are all naturally parallel. The things that are not parallel are the languages. So I'm going to skip over this section here, which is a qualitative discussion of the various capabilities of high-performance Fortran. And instead skip forward in these foils to an actual description of high-performance Fortran so that you will stand some chance of eventually using this, I mean, actually doing something real. So even here, we start with a few rather general remarks, but we're going to get quite soon into a description of the language. And I think I mentioned, my secretary's away today. You will get copies of these files tomorrow, as long as she's back. And so, so we've essentially discussed this already, that the essential feature of high-performance Fortran is that it's expressed explicitly, and in my opinion, at least in principle, that is good, because if the parallelism is transparent, that means we properly, faithfully recorded the problem, because the parallelism was transparent in the problem. And as we will discuss, there are array expressions, including the conditional where instruction, libraries. Probably the most powerful and important HPF statement is for all, which wasn't obvious when we started. When we started, we thought array expressions would be the most powerful. But I think in retrospect, if you look at practical code, what people use most often is the so-called for all instruction. There is also an independent assertion on do loops, which is essentially in there, if you remember our discussion of problem architecture last time, the independent assertion is to do the embarrassingly parallel problems. So I've essentially made this remark in with possibly a slightly different foil before. So we could write, here we have some Fortran 90, which says where the array B is greater than not, set A equal to B, otherwise or elsewhere set A equal to not. So that copies B into A, but sets A equal to not if B is positive. So we could, if we wrote it like this, and as long as our HPF compiler was any good, we'll be guaranteed to get excellent parallelism, because there's obvious parallelism just by looping over the indices I and J. Now if our HPF compiler is very good, it will also take this equivalent Fortran 77 code, which just has the two do loops over I and J for a two-dimensional arrays A and B, and has an if statement instead of a where statement, because if is the element, the where statement in Fortran 90 is the array equivalent of the if statement. I mean, they're otherwise essentially identical. And so you are allowed to write these do loops, but I believe the vendors will not guarantee to recognize parallelism. Here they should, because there is nothing in those do loops which obscures the parallelism. So I would expect most compilers to parallelize both versions quite well. Now the reason we like for all, which we will discuss, is that the for all statement is the compiler is guaranteed to be able to parallelize, because it is guaranteed there are no dependencies between the different loops which will cause the for all statement to not be parallelizable. So HPF has all of Fortran 90. That has caused, as I mentioned, the vendors great trouble, because Fortran 90 is a very complex language. It has these new instructions for all and independence, which enhance do loops to essentially make them parallel. It has assertions which allow you to, which are comment statements, which allow the compiler to optimize the mapping of data. Something that people have tried long and hard to put into, actually to any parallel language, is how to do parallel input-output. HPF does not have any official parallel input and output, but I don't think any language does. I still remember there was a conference in Pasadena in January 92, where we were discussing HPCC technologies, and we were reviewing where the software was. And well, my ex-student John Salmon, who was still at Caltech, he got up in this lecture hall and asked, "Well, it's a pretty sad commentary on the field that nobody will actually..." Well, he doesn't use Fortran, he uses C. So he commented that nobody knows what a printf means in a parallel environment. So there is actually no agreement as to what parallel I.O. means. And then when you write a printf in a parallel program, does printf produce output from every node, or maybe just from one node? Namely, if you remember the SPMD programming style, you can have scalars there which are actually going to and you may not actually typically want usually actually what you want when you do a printf is for the output to come out from just one node, not from all of them. But there are in fact no agreed parallel. There are private libraries that do I.O. in various ways, but there's no agreement as to what parallel I.O. should be. Okay. Something which, at least in principle, is quite important is extrinsics. Extrinsics are a way of joining, at least in practice, joining high-performance Fortran with message passing. So when you give up on your compiler and it's still giving lousy performance, or you're doing something which you know the compiler doesn't support, HPF does support the calling of MPI directly from HPF programs. So that's analogous between, from C or Fortran calling assembly language. So we've already analyzed enough about parallelism to notice that two keys to performance are load balancing, getting the same amount of work in each processor, and the other key is to minimize the amount of communication. And the purpose of the so-called data mapping assertions, which are telling the compiler where to put the data, is so that the user can help the compiler place the data in the right processor to minimize communication. Now, the compiler, with one or two exceptions that we won't come to today, always uses the so-called owner computes rule. So the owner compute rule says that if you have a variable such as A of IJ, an element of an array, you do the computation of AIJ on the processor where it is stored. It's not entirely obvious that, in fact, there are some cases where that's not the most efficient, but let's give an example. If AIJ was set equal to a bunch of stuff which was all stored on a totally different processor, and so there were 10 variables stored on a different processor from AIJ, rather than bring the 10 variables to the processor where AIJ is and then do the computation, it would be far more efficient to, say, do the computation on the 10 variables in the processor where they live, and then transmit one number, the result of that computation. But in general, most expressions don't have that feature, and a very good heuristic, which is certainly true in all the examples we've looked at, is the owner computes rule, that you always do the computing on the processor which owns the right, the left-hand side of an expression. So that's actually a philosophically very important point, because that tells you that once you've assigned the data mapping, namely where things are stored, you've also assigned the computing. Because computing with the owner compute rule is uniquely associated with the placement of the data. So that should be contrasted totally with most of the work on shared memory machines, which uses so-called control parallelism, where you have a do loop. So when you have do I equals 1 to 100 and 10 processors, you might assign the first 10 instances of the do loop to one processor, the next 10 to another, and so on. So the control parallelism is not assigning processing by the location of data, it's assigning processing by the value of indices. So it's a very other different, totally different strategy. But for data parallelism, which is what HPF is designed to support, the owner computes rule is almost always a good rule. And it's your responsibility as a programmer to tell HPF where to put the data in such a way that the owner computes rule will be efficient. So you may remember, I think I discussed the classic loosely synchronous programming style where you transmit do all the communication, then you do the computing. So the owner computes rule naturally implements that, because if you have one or more left-hand sides, the rule is look at all the right-hand sides, see where the data is stored, bring all the data to the processor, which owns the datum on the left-hand side, get them all there so that at this stage we have every processor has in it all the data necessary to do the computation of the left-hand side. Then you do the computation as just an ordinary assignment with no communication. So HPF automatically implements the obvious, the natural communicate-compute cycle, which is the classic SPMD loosely synchronous programming model. So HPF has some sort of directives which affect the efficiency of the computation, but do not change the value. They do have some things which actually change the value, like a for all statement is actually a different syntax from a do loop thing. However, a lot of the critical instructions in HPF are just assertions added to Fortran 90 code, and that's one of the reasons it says that a typical HPF code should be compilable by a Fortran 90 compiler. You get the right answer on a sequential machine, then you hand it to your HPF compiler, which hopefully makes sensible use of your assertions and then uses those assertions to get efficient code. So the assertions are meant to, especially the data mapping assertions, are designed to affect the efficiency of the code but not the result of the code. while here this foil dismisses all the hard work compiler people do. An HPF compiler typically will produce Fortran plus message passing, and so in some people call that a translator. Namely, they would say a true compiler ought to directly produce native machine code, the executable for the machine, whereas most HPF compilers produce Fortran, node Fortran plus message passing. At some time, I think we thought that it might be better to have compilers that directly mapped onto the machine. I think the most flexible is to have to do it in two phases, where you go from HPF to Fortran plus message passing. Fortran plus message passing, you compile a Fortran using your native node compiler. The message passing hopefully is something like MPI, a message passing standard, which you then execute the result in code. Now, a major effort in traditional compilers is data flow and dependency analysis, which is basically critical in optimizing Fortran 77. An HPF compiler really only requires to do that when it sees Fortran 77. And when it sees do loops, it must do that. When it sees array instructions or intrinsic or for alls, it is not necessary, at least not. It might be advisable, but certainly not, I don't think it's necessary to do such that complicated analysis. So then it's got to use these assertions to organize the computation by knowing where things are stored. So once it's broken up an array into parts, it can take what was originally a giant do loop over the entire array and break it up into do loops within each processor, which then will implement that owner computes rule. And I've already pointed out that it will implement this so-called loosely synchronous model of communicate compute phases, where it basically does all the communication and does all the computing. Now, we've already mentioned at length that at least all MIMDI machines have a serious problem with latency. Namely, you must send large messages. So one very important optimization, which is actually where the dependency analysis can be useful, is to maximize the size of the messages. So what you do that by so-called blocking messages. You analyze your resultant Fortran plus message passing code, and you try to see if you can take a bunch of small messages and join them up to make one big message. You may remember in Laplace's equation, we needed to send essentially one data element from each neighboring processor for updating all the points on the boundary. Well, the initial analysis might find out each of those communications of one data point, independent atomic communications. Then the task of blocking will be to join together those separate single variable communications into one large communication, which is in that case totally legal and will not lead to problems. So that's an essential optimization, and many compilers, certainly a lot of the original compilers, produced truly terrible results because they did not do that optimization properly. Finally, the compiler will be very closely dependent on the runtime library, because when we do all these array instructions, and the array instructions will use Fortran 90 or HPF intrinsics, the basic built-in functions, where the parallelism will have already been built into the runtime library invoked by the compiler, it's obviously very important that the runtime library be extremely efficient. So that's an area that we work quite a bit at Syracuse. And one of our interests in parallel Java is that this low-level libraries are likely to be the same whether you have a high-level language of C, C++, Fortran, or Java, because the runtime library just implements algorithms. It implements parallel prefix algorithms, or broadcasts, or parallel summations, and things like that. So it's those are algorithms which, whether you happen to code the high-level language in Java or Fortran, shouldn't make any difference. So there's every reason to believe that one can build, and lots of people in fact have done this, you can reuse runtime library between languages. All right. So, they're meant to start with typically exclamation mark HPF. And there are two types of syntax illustrated here. There's this double colon syntax, which is which is actually a Fortran 90 syntax, where you have the this rather peculiarly termed attributed form, which has all the descriptors here, and then it has the variables which are being described after the double colon. Here, this type of form mixes the attributes and the variables. So typically, this form here is used when you have several variables that you want to specify. Alright, so we'll start by discussing data mapping. And data mapping is all you need to do as long as you are using very explicit parallelism. So if your entire program, as in the Fortran, I mean when we did HPF for Laplace equation, we wrote everything in terms of the array syntax. There was all there was. It was just arrays and functions on arrays. So as long as the only thing we have to do for such an HPF program is to tell the compiler where to put the data. It requires no other parallel instructions because the compiler knows that A equals B plus C can be implemented in parallel, and it knows how to do it. And if it has a Fortran 90 function, it knows the parallel implementation of every Fortran 90 function because that's what's built into its runtime library. So as long as everything's expressed at the array level as opposed to the element level, all we need to do is tell the compiler where to put the data. And so that's the simplest form of HPF. The problem with that form is that we will find that when we get to the more interesting or more complicated algorithms, we will find it rather hard to express it using the existing arrays. The real problem is the existing functions. You can view the so-called for all instruction as a method of generating general intrinsic functions which manipulate arrays. Because the standard suite of sums and prefixes and scatters are just insufficient for a lot of applications because they require a more complicated structure in the algorithm. And so, although data mapping is all we need for this particular class of problem, as I said, I think the majority of HPF will require for all, and we will discuss for all, presumably not today. And as it said here, it's the owner compute rule that says that as long as the instructions are explicitly parallel, which array instructions are, all we have to do is to map the data. It mentions here that towards the end of this discussion, we will mention the so-called HPF2 extensions. HPF2 is meant to get its final public inspection at Supercomputing 96 conference in November, and it has a set of simplifications and extensions of HPF. One of the extensions is actually a violation of the, well, it's not a violation, it's a way for the programmer to tell the compiler not to use the owner compute store. So that's what it says here by the on home. Okay. So we're going to look at the distribute command and the corresponding dynamic redistribute command and the align and the corresponding dynamic realign command. Alright. So HPF has an unreasonably complicated way of specifying the data mapping, which reflects the result of consensus, and it is that's just life. You can avoid the complexity. It doesn't have to be as complex. The stage mapping where you define a template, align a data object with a template, map a template to an abstract processor, set of processors, and then map the abstract processors to physical processors, you can avoid these various steps with just having a single distributed command. Well, people who are familiar with the CM2 or CM5, especially the CM2 and CM Fortran, will be very comfortable with the concept of a template, because the programming model for the connection machine was famous for the concept of a virtual processor. And essentially, a template is the set of virtual processors. And the idea of a template, I guess to me, is very reasonable, because if you take any problem, there's essentially, at least if you view it as a data parallel problem, there is almost always a sort of maximal amount of parallelism. If you look at the Jacobi iteration, there's a maximal parallelism coming from it from doing every grid point on a separate processor. That's the maximal amount of parallelism that's reasonable. If you do particle dynamics, the parallelism is the number of particles. So if you take any sort of physical problem, there's usually some sort of fundamental entity, and there's a maximal parallelism coming from putting one of those fundamental entities on one node of a processor. Now, you never put one fundamental entity on a node of a processor for two reasons. You don't have enough processors, and the other reason is even if you did have enough processors, it will be incredibly inefficient because of the very high communication overhead. Remember, we found the communication overhead went down, like in two dimensions, one over the square root of the number of points in each processor. So if you have 1 point, square root of one is a pretty big number, and typically you have more like 10,000 points in a realistic problem in each processor, so you reduce the communication overhead. So any real problem always has more than one point. However, so the conceptually, these fundamental sort of physical entities or virtual processors do represent the natural unit of parallelism. And so a template is this abstract space of virtual processors, or what it's called here somewhat peculiarly, index positions. And a template is defined as just like an array. So you define a template here as a one or two dimensional array. And you can, so it just looks like that. Now, a template, at least in most implementations, would take no space, because this is just a conceptual thing. It just says that for this problem, let's take the case of T1000. If I took a Laplace equation in one dimension, which is just second d squared f dx squared, some second order differential equation, and with 1,000 grid points, then the template for that problem is the one-dimensional template T of 1,000. If I take Laplace's equation as we went through it with a 16 by 16 grid, the natural template is T of 16 comma 16. It has one entry for every fundamental entity. Now, a template, it's just at the moment, it's just, if you like, labeling the virtual processes. We're going to, associated with each virtual processes, we're going to have quantities. Alright, so I guess we'll come back and discuss those quantities in a little bit. So now let's quickly discuss the other rather abstract object, which is, if you like, template is the abstraction of the problem, processes in HPF are the abstraction of computers. So you could take the approach in HPF is you always map into the physical machine. But an alternative approach is to set up abstract processes which you map into, and then you can map the abstract processes into real machines. The advantage of doing that is you can set up your HPF program with the right structure, because if you take the two-dimensional Laplace equation, we know that the natural set of processes to map that onto is a two-dimensional grid of processes, because that's the natural mapping. And so it would be very reasonable for such a problem to set up an abstract processor grid which was a two-dimensional grid. Actually, this could have even some reality in that suppose I set up an abstract processor grid for, say, it's 4x4 for that Laplace example. If I ran that on a 4 real processors, I could actually implement that as 16 separate threads with 4 threads per processor. So I could actually say these abstract processors map to physical processes, and I'll have more than one physical process per processor. So, and that's actually a very natural thing to do, and it's certainly a reasonable way for HPF to implement the processor's directive. So you can view processors could be viewed not just as abstract, but as the real processes, which processes then get mapped in a final step onto the final processors. So there is a processor's directive, which defaults actually to a single processor sequential, but otherwise is basically an array syntax. Of course, you see somehow the strengths and weaknesses of Fortran. The strength of Fortran is that it has truly excellent capabilities of dealing with arrays, whether they be arrays of data elements or here arrays of processors. The weakness of Fortran is that it has great strengths for arrays and not terribly good strengths for any other data structures. So Fortran was born in the days when scientific computing was dominated by arrays. And is it still actually, if not dominated by arrays, pervaded by arrays, because arrays are certainly the natural data structure to describe the world, because the world is three-dimensional. And that would appear to be naturally described in most problems by three-dimensional arrays, and if you do two-dimensional problems, two-dimensional arrays. So there is no doubt that even if we want to have nifty linked lists or trees or what have you as data structures, arrays are, I mean, nature has chosen arrays to have a special significance. The problem, of course, is that even in a three-dimensional world described by an array, when we do a multi-grid or some adaptive algorithm, the resultant data structure doesn't look like a simple array so obviously. So actually, this particular foil illustrates several things. We have a template called X, which has 40 elements. We have, so this, remember, takes no space. It's just an abstract thing. We have here three arrays, A, B, C, also dimension 40, and we have four processors. So this actually already sort of gives us a hint of the two basic instructions, which are align and distribute. So what does align tell you? So align tells you the following, and it's sort of, at least conceptually, quite interesting. I remember I told you templates label the fundamental entities in our world, in our virtual processes. Now, a given virtual processor or a given entity in our world will typically have several attributes. If I'm doing quantum chromodynamics, then my world is actually spanned by a four-dimensional grid of gluons. Those gluon particles are described by eight complex entities, or 16 Fortran variables. So such a fundamental entity, so each of the template points actually has 16 values associated with it, which you could describe by 16 arrays. Again, when we do, for instance, numerical relativity, that is naturally described by 10 points at each point in three-dimensional space. If you do computational fluid dynamics, then you have pressure, energy, and velocity, a three velocity, that's 5 points described at each point in space. So most physical problems, they associate with every element of the template, or every template position, maybe more precisely, a bunch of things. And so that's what the align assertion is meant to do. The align tells you how to associate with a given template position the attributes. So in most cases, the aligner is actually done in a very simple fashion, which is illustrated here. We essentially have an abstract world, which is of size 40. We label it abstractly with X. We have three attributes defined at each point, which are just AI, BI, and CI, I running from 1 to 40. We want to make certain that AI, BI, and CI are always stored in the same processor and therefore associated with the same virtual processor. So we align with X, which AI, A, B, and C, which guarantees that a given element of A, B, and C will always be stored in the same processor, because they're going to be stored in the same virtual processor, which is a template index, and we will always assign everything associated with a given template index to a given processor. So align is a pretty useful instruction, because it's going to guarantee that you properly associate the various components of the problem together. And align has a great deal of complexity, we'll see later on, most of which is not necessary and is really an exercise in linguistics. However, some of it can be used. Alright, so we've defined four processes here, which have four different colors. And here we are asserting the distribution of the template. If the template is the set of virtual processors, once we've asserted the distribution of the template, then the distribution of the arrays, which are aligned with the template, follows. So we have arrays, so we haven't described these particular distributions, but we can but it's not terribly surprising that one of the natural distributions, which is very common, which has a special name, is the so-called block distribution. So a block distribution in one dimension says that if you have, in this case here, an array of size 40, And for processors, the block distribution puts elements 1 through 10 in the first processor, 11 through 20 in the second, 21 through 30 in the third, 31 through 40 in the fourth. And it's called block because we block the elements of the arrays together. And we know from the process example that for any problem where there's locality, where the communication is between neighbors in the array indices, the block distribution is always going to be a good distribution. So a block distribution is designed for particle problems, partial differential equation problems, any of the computations where the basic algorithms are local. And it's probably the most important of the simple distribution. It's the most commonly used. It's the one you do for any PDE problem, at least none. So these statements here, if we now take a typical Fortran 90 instruction, C equals A plus B, we told the system everything it wanted to know. We told it how to assign C, A, and B to processors, and the parallelism is applied by the owner compute rule. Notice that this has implicitly load balancing, because the block distribution, well, as long as the number of processors divides the number of the array dimension okay, I mean the template dimension okay, it will automatically assign equal numbers of array elements to each processor. If you look at HPF2, you have the ability to actually put different block sizes in each processor, but for these simple problems, which for most simple problems which you're using the block distribution for, you don't want that. You want equal number of virtual processors or template positions in each physical processor, because that will guarantee load balancing, because for most of these array operations, the computational complexity is independent of the array index. So load balancing is gotten when we just have equal numbers of each element in each processor. So let's see. Alright. Alright, so the syntax of a line is can either have these attributed form or this the more natural form where you align something with something else. Now you can actually align you can either align arrays with templates or arrays with arrays. So templates in some sense are optional, because if we go back to that previous example where we had A, B, and C, well, we could have said, well, let's not bother with this funny thing called X. Let's just distribute A and then align B and C with A. So in a somewhat simpler model, you choose, if you like, one of the attributes of importance of the virtual processor. You distribute that one attribute, and then you align everything else with respect to that one attribute. So a template is, in principle, I think, always redundant. You can always do it without templates, because because you're going to align one or more arrays with a template, you can always take one of those arrays, distribute it, and then align every other array with the chosen array. So the only reason for to put in a template is if you feel it's sort of elegant, you can give the template a name called, which maybe expresses what it is, so that it's really a sort of conceptual issue. It has some conceptual clarity which is absent from not using it, but I do not believe it's necessary. Although I think the logical argument that goes with virtual processors is very important and extremely interesting, because that is still the fundamental unit of parallelism. So to think of these as groups, these A, B, and C as grouped together, is still the right way to do it. All right. So here's a bunch of examples which will we can use. So a very common notation is the colon notation. And we can either use colons or these sort of abstract indices I and J. So in the colon notation, you align, which you can hardly see, I need to change the font here. You align A of colon with B of colon. That says take every array element of A and align it so it's exactly the same syntax, same position as B. So as long as you're matching indices exactly, which you are actually in most examples, you do not need to specify indices. Whereas if you wanted to, say, displace A of I with, if you want to align A of I with B of I minus 1, you would want to use this index notation. So the bottom example is one with a two-dimensional colon notation. So I believe that a line is a relatively straightforward concept, and how to use it. Usually the align statements, at least in my opinion, are quite obvious from the problem. So a line is an example of a very problem-oriented declaration, because you really should be able to work out from the nature of the problem what the right type of alignment is. It shouldn't be some difficult algorithm to find out how to do alignment, although actually there are there is computer science work which is meant to generate I should say that align statements and distribute statements could in principle be derived from the program by analysis. The reason why I think that, although that people have done interesting work in that area, that hasn't proven to be too popular, because actually it's not too difficult to find for the user to decide how to do it. In particular, a line is usually very easy. So if you don't understand the problem well enough to know how the arrays should be oriented with respect to each other, then probably you shouldn't be programming the example anyway. Of course, the poor old compiler, which has no idea where the problem's coming from, it does not know that there's computational fluid dynamics and these funny things called U and rho and E are just density, energy, and velocity. The compiler has, in principle, no idea that these are just different components of the same fluid position, and therefore, obviously, should be aligned together. So that's an example. You know, so the align allows the user to express obvious, typically obvious features of the problem to the compiler. Now, the distribute command, which tells you once you've done the alignment where you put the data, that's usually less obvious. It's often less obvious, because that's some optimizing communication type algorithm, and for a complicated problem, that can be non-trivial. So whereas the line comes automatically from the problem, distribute, which is involves both the problem and the computer, because you are distributing onto a virtual or a real computer, that I see is clearly harder. It's not, in fact, in general, requires actually running a complicated load balancing algorithm, which is NP complete, to be able to find out the right assignments. Okay. So as long as my secretary is in tomorrow, we will have copies of these and all the following FOIAs on HPF available, hopefully by lunchtime. Did we give out the copies of the Kivang thing? So.